Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 24th of August. It is episode 74. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up this week. We're going to be talking to IPA Executive Director John Roskam.
The Big Cheese.
The Big Cheese here at the IPA. We're going to be talking to him about the IPA's brand new podcast, the Great Books of Literature podcast. And we're also going to be talking to him about how, well, Scott Morrison is now the Prime Minister as of about 40 seconds ago probably.
Mm-hmm.
And why, you know, you can't solve it with just Scott Morrison. The Liberal Party needs to get back on the right track. And we're also going to be talking to Daniel Wilde, one of our best friends here at the podcast, about his report last week on the Paris Climate Accords and what that was going to cost Australia. And yeah, really great chat as well. So we can start with the big news for the podcast, or we can start with the big news for Australia. I know which one I care about more, and I know which one I probably should care about a bit more than I do.
Let's go to the podcast.
Let's go podcast. So last week, we had the Douglas Murray interview. Big moment for the podcast. The video of the interview has already got over 10,000 views on YouTube and 12,000 views. Mm. Wow. In the last 2 or 3 days after Douglas Murray tweeted, a 54-minute interview. Go back through if you haven't listened to it already, and you might not have listened to it because that interview was so popular that we crashed the website.
Mm.
We absolutely destroyed the IPS website for multiple days. I had people emailing me over the weekend saying, where's the podcast? They couldn't access it because the website was down.
So that's your fault.
Yeah, it's probably my fault. So to give you guys an idea, because, you know, we might have some listeners who had to wait about 3 or 4 extra days, or maybe they never really got around to listening to the Douglas Murray interview. So iTunes doesn't host podcasts. Like, you need to set up another place to host podcasts, and then iTunes distributes it out. So we hosted it on our website, and then it will go out through iTunes. And it just got to a point where all the people were trying to download the Douglas Murray interview at the same time, and we broke the website. So we've moved to a new one. So this one, I'm 98% sure, is going to go out fine.
Nana was pretty unhappy because it made her job as membership.
Yeah.
Junior Vice President of membership.
Yeah. I've been
Junior Vice President. No, head honcho. Vice President Grand Poobah.
I'm a bit upset because I was like, suddenly the website's down, and I was trying to do my job as a membership manager to keep all my membership rate up.
Yeah. Your quotas and stuff. You got KPIs.
People's calling and emailing me like, the website's down. Yes, I'm so sorry. Because they can't renew online.
Yeah.
But of course, the person who was most angry, James.
Yes. Well, we need to apologize. But first, I want to say we are a team, Nina. So, you know.
We're still cool.
Fine.
She's partially responsible, though.
Yeah, as one third of the team.
I'm just doing the button.
No, you see, you're downplaying it now when the chips are down. Yeah, but we should apologize to the number one person we've heard here at the IPA, which is Sammy Thoreau, our IT graphic guy, and we've made his week a bit of a stink. Mm. He's been on the phone with developers a lot, so we thought we'd just take this time at the start of the show to publicly apologize to Sammy. Sammy, I'm very sorry. Like Icarus, Pete and I and Nina flew too close to the sun, and we got burned, and so did you. So my apologies for crashing the website. It won't happen again now that we've moved over to Podbean. I'm sorry.
I'm not sorry. That's your job.
Wowee. Peter Gregory. From the top row, Pete.
Anyway.
Okay, so that's what we wanted to say. So the podcast is back online now. If you did miss last week's interview with Douglas Murray, you can go back and listen to it. And yeah, that's all I got to say on that. Let's get to this Prime Ministership. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, Prime Minister what?
Prime Ministership.
Oh, okay.
What did you think I said?
I said something else.
All right, well.
The family podcast, yeah. Mate.
Yeah, we've had leadership spills. I think we can acknowledge that, the elephant in the room over the week. And as we'll talk about with John Roskam later, it's fun popcorn, like who's going to be Prime Minister. Mm. But as the video I keep sharing around the office, it is John Jackson versus Jack Johnson. Like you've just got a bunch of clones of the same sort of ideas of the Liberal Party.
You should explain that reference.
Yeah, so it's a Futurama reference and they're watching a political debate and it's two actual clones with the exact same policies arguing against each other. Mm. Which is kind of how I feel watching this leadership thing. Like, none of you are committed to repealing Section 18C. None of you are committed to getting out of Paris. None of you are committed to free speech, tax cuts, anything.
Yeah.
So it's fun popcorn, and you get to see a lot of people running around very busy on their phones. And
walking into rooms.
Walking into rooms, walking out of rooms. Oh, we were just watching the like they've got a camera on the doors and the doors are closed and they're having the meeting inside. And there's just two security guards standing outside. And it's just like, you will never analyze what your regular standing position is more than when you've got 17 cameras on you. You're like, what am I doing the right thing with my hands? Is this normal? Should I be up a bit more?
Do I shuffle too much? Yeah.
So hard's out to them. They're the real victims of all
this. Oh, they are. And look, all the journos fall over each other to get so you can get the first text from
inside. Yeah, Twitter's fun. And I got to say, like, this particular leadership struggle, and we've been through enough leadership struggles the last 6 years, this one has been particularly bloody and high maintenance, I reckon. Like, there are military coups which go smoother than the last few days in Australian politics.
The what was it? The October Revolution was much quicker than this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they would have had a better energy policy. So,
Turn it off.
Yeah, well,
it's a shorter energy policy.
I don't think the Bolsheviks were big on renewable energy.
Yeah, well, they are now, that's for sure.
But it's as you said, it's telling that there was just no discussion about difference in policies.
Yeah, exactly. It was personality.
Yeah, not much of that either.
Yeah.
That was a little draw as well.
Yeah, very good.
No offense.
Yeah, in a way, like, the good thing about, if our listeners are out there going, well, I really thought Peter Dutton would turn this around, the reason I'm kind of happy Peter Dutton's not Prime Minister is I would have had to put up with 5 months of Voldemort jokes.
Yeah.
And I am so glad we are out on that one.
Get it?
Yeah, because like he's bald and like Voldemort's a bad guy. You get it?
Yeah.
Like
it's
5 months of
looks
that.
Looks like Voldemort.
5 months. Yep. And Mr. Potato Head. So I'm glad we don't have to deal with that.
Well, I'm glad I don't have to deal with the... There was just so much Dutton hate, like as if his policies are any different to anyone else's.
Yeah, exactly. And just because he's the ministership in that particular office, it's like he's the bad guy,
and it's like, you know, so many Facebook statuses of if Peter Dutton gets in, I'm moving to New Zealand.
You're not.
It's like, you're probably not, because she's slashing immigration over there.
Yeah, exactly.
Donald Trump. I mean, sorry, just into her turn.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, good luck getting a house over there if you've moved to New Zealand.
So you hate Dutton because
His
immigration stance, but not Jacinda.
Anyway. And I got to say, like, as a man that likes a good scorched earth when he sees it, or scorched earth approach, more than the earth itself.
Yeah.
Turnbull's last few days, I mean, hats off to the guy. If you're going to bring everyone down with you, that's how you do it. Like, just completely making up rules on the fly as to when you're going to call an election. Yeah. Call a leadership spill. You got to take your hats off.
Well, the theory on that was he wanted to... If he had got done yesterday, he would have been equal with Gough Whitlam in time in office.
And so now he's... Yeah. So now, historical fun fact, he's served for one more day than Gough Whitlam.
Yep.
So, you know, worth it.
There you go.
He's made up a new rule. Only if a majority of MPs put their names to a petition would he call the meeting. Never been done before. He's just like, that's the new rule. Like when you're playing at the playground and one kid like lost and he's like, actually, if you look at the bylaw that I just created in my head, I actually won.
Well, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking to John Roskam a bit more in depth because, again, like this is personality and it's popcorn and it's fun, but the policies won't change and that's the real problem here.
Mm.
And that's why the Liberals aren't looking too good and why members are upset. So John Roskam is going to be talking a lot more about that later in the show.
And, of course, check out the IPA's video on what the new Prime Minister should do.
Yes. So mere seconds ago, I pressed publish on our Facebook and Twitter pages. I hope it's going well. I haven't checked my phone. But basically, so we've got our staff members saying, okay, here are the policy platforms we want to see the new Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, take. I wonder if, like, because we immediately rushed into the studio to do this podcast. What if it's an Oscars moment and that everyone has said it's ScoMo and we go out and it's Peter Dutton?
Mm. Well, we do.
Do we redo the show?
We do pre-record this, quite well. James. We'll just bleep it out.
The names
all the same.
Cool. So, other stories we got. So, this got buried in the avalanche of political stories this week. But Malcolm Turnbull has shut down talk of a corporate tax cut reform. Well, part of the corporate tax cut reform on Wednesday. Doesn't look like it's going to get back up anytime soon. So, this is something we've been talking about in the podcast a lot. Something the IPA has been talking about a lot. Pete, do you want to talk about it more?
I do. What I liked, actually, can you run through your take on why this was such a political failure for Turnbull? I liked that. You know, when you said you made it like so everyone like.
Oh, right. Yeah. Failure. So, well, I say this in the Dan interview. But so, yeah. Well, so in the middle of all this, like, you know, the Dutton's challenging again. People are losing their faith.
Yep.
Turnbull calls a press conference and everyone's like, this will be the one where he says, you know, come at the king, you better not miss. And so he's there and he's got the cameras. He's got Corman. He's got Scott Morrison, if I recall, well, like by his side. Like,
yeah.
And it's going to be the big press conference, and he announces that corporate tax cuts got canned. Yep. So he's made sure everyone's tuning in to watch him announce a failure.
Another thing I didn't quite get right.
Which I don't get. Like, what is the argument for doing that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's, yeah, I don't know. Maybe
how do we distract everyone from this? I know. Copy. Announce I lost at something.
So what were the actual specifics of this announcement, James?
Okay, so tax cuts for businesses with an annual turnover of up to $50 million have already passed Parliament.
Okay.
Now, this is the tax cuts for businesses with an annual turnover of more than $50
million. Oh.
So that was going to go down from 30%, where it currently is, to 25%, which was going to be modest and was going to take forever to fully implement, as we've talked about in the podcast. But yes, it was going to be something. And now we're going to have nothing.
Yeah.
And as we talk about with Dan later in the show, who's done a hell of a lot of research on why corporate tax cuts are a good idea, it's going to make Australia less competitive internationally.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to, that's basically it. Like, you've got Trump, he's slashing corporate tax cuts as much as he can. Other countries are following suit, and Australia's completely dropped the ball.
Yeah, well, I mean, I sort of say this in both interviews, so I won't expand the point too much, but I don't understand how cutting taxes is difficult to sell.
Yeah. It's a weird one.
Everyone loves cutting taxes.
All right, let's move on. So we've got another one here, a free speech story coming out of the US.
Yes, that's right, James. More than 300 publications from the United States have committed to a Boston Globe coordinated effort to run editorials on Thursday promoting freedom of the press. In light of President Trump's frequent attacks on the media, the Globe initiative comes amid the president's repeated verbal attacks, on journalists, calling mainstream press organisations fake news, and of course the big one was the enemy of the American people. This came to a boil in August when the CNN reporter Jim Acosta, one of our favourites here on the podcast.
Sir. Sir, resign.
Yeah. He's so brave. Walked out of a press briefing because Sarah Sanders refused to talk back, deny Trump's thing that they were the enemy of the people. My take on this, James, I don't think it says anywhere in the Constitution of America that the president has to be nice to the media.
No.
They're a pack of sooks.
Yeah.
These guys are sooks.
Well, the other part, which Morgan pointed out in Hay yesterday, was one of the papers that joined this was, well, it's more of a magazine, but The Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
And The Atlantic were like, you know, get the actual quote here. So, it is your right as an American to read what you will, to write what you think, and publish what you believe.
Yeah.
Unless your name is Kevin Williamson.
Yeah.
Like, if you guys don't recall Kevin Williamson being the guy who lasted one article at The Atlantic before they went in, found a tweet from 10 years ago and fired him.
Yeah. Like, how can you...
And I get, like, you know, there's some people going, technically, free speech. And Williamson's free speech isn't threatened because he doesn't have a right to work at The Atlantic.
Yeah, they can sack whatever they
want. But, like, the point being, if you're The Atlantic and you're like, everyone should read what they need to read, everyone should hear what they want to hear,
yeah. You
can't also fire Kevin Williamson for one tweet.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't.
It's completely hypocritical. You literally have the freest press in the world. Like, your press is protected by the Constitution better than any other place in the world. You know, the president doesn't have to be nice to you. You know, you only like him because he, you know, is popular because he repudiates the press. Sorry, you only dislike him. And you're a big sook.
There you go.
All of you, particularly Jim Acosta.
I'll send this one straight to him. Can I just jump back a bit to the leadership thing? This is another one I want to say. So Turnbull gets the... Dutton presents the whip with the 43 signatures, which was required to trigger the meeting in the rule that Turnbull came up with.
Yep.
He didn't hand over the thing to the whip. So the whip goes to Turnbull and says, they've got the petition. And he says, I want to see it. And the whip says, I don't have it. Dutton has it. And so Turnbull says, call every person and see if they are signing it. It's just like... Really, mate? I'm going to call 43 people. Hey, you still there? Yeah, cool. Imagine call 27. That would be not fun.
These are the schoolyard games. These are the schoolyard games of the Australian people.
Cool. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. These are our elected politicians. Yep. We get the people we deserve. That's it for stories we want to talk about at the top. So here's what's... the IPA has basically just been all about this leadership thing and the policy positions we want to see. So that's basically been the flavour of what we've been about. You can go read John Roskam's article, which we talk to him about later in the show. And you can also read Sinclair's article, which is basically saying how you think Dutton's bad, you think Morrison's bad, you're upset about that. Look at Labor's economic policies and just realise what you have at the moment.
Mm.
Really good one. Another interesting media alert, I don't know if you saw this come through this morning, but Gideon Rosner, one of our research fellows here, a tweet of his about Trial by Kyle, the new Channel 10 pilot show.
Trial by what?
Trial by Kyle. It's a show hosted by Kyle Sandilands. And it's like a Judge Judy setup. But Gideon's like tweet about the show got embedded in an article which went like across all of the AAP media.
Really?
We got 60 mentions of Gideon's article this morning.
What was he saying?
I think it's like so bad that it's actually quite good or something like that. But yeah, that's like if we're talking about what LCIPS said this week, I can't ignore Gideon Wilson's take on Trial by Kyle.
It sounds like what Gideon, something Gideon would like.
It does. All right. So thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, and Podbean.
Yes.
And you can also find links through our website. It won't be on our website anymore. So that's how you can access the show. And you can go back and listen to the Douglas Murray interview if you are one of the people that missed out last week because we crushed the website because we're just that popular. If you do like the show on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us a 5-star review. So there is some confusion as to how you do it. So I'll just address that. So I just downloaded the new iOS, so I don't quite know how it works on previous ones, but if you do just search the podcast or if you go to our podcast page and just scroll down, you will be prompted to tap a review. So make sure you leave us a 5-star review. You can also leave us a comment, a tip for a show, or maybe something you want to hear us talk about. And Nina, if people want to become a member of the IPA, how can they become a member?
Well, you can start by visiting our website, ipa.org.au, finger cross it up, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Okay, let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we are now joined once again by IPA Executive Director and podcast superstar, John Roskin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, James. Hi, Pete.
G'day, John. It's always hard to get a hold of John. And
busy, you know, man.
Always a big deal.
Yes, exactly. So last week was a very exciting week. So we launched...
Pete. No, you know I've got an open door policy. You can come in any time.
Yeah, in terms of a podcast interview, these are pretty rare though. This is just our second.
Yeah, well, we've now got a different podcast.
Yeah, Pete, well, that's true. Yeah,
which we'll talk about.
Bit of a dueling banjo situation. So yeah, so last week, very exciting week for the IPA. We launched the Great Books of Literature podcast. Mm-hmm. It's going to be you and Andrew Bolt.
Hosted by you, James.
Yes, I'm hosting. I'm asking the questions from IPA members. So this is a podcast where you and Andrew are going to be discussing the 10 great books of civilization and their impacts that they've had on literature canon, what the books mean to modern society. I'll just go through the books now. So
when are you going to announce how we went?
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, that was going to be the first question.
We're going to advertise.
Yeah. So we've had one episode come out so far, Bleak House by Charles Dickens, and that reached number one in the arts category on iTunes, which is a huge success. So yeah, that. Well, first question, what's it like to be a podcast superstar?
I feel like
superstar?
Jordan Peterson.
Yeah? But big time.
Big time. No, yep. Look, but it does reveal something that we've known and people have spoken to us about and, in fact, is why we launched the Foundations of Western Civilization program back in 2010, which is people are looking for intellectual nourishment. They are looking to discuss ideas and themes and the history of our humanity. And it's been a lot of fun. We're about halfway through taping the episodes and the response from the public and from IPA members has been fantastic.
Absolutely. So...
Oh, sorry. Could I ask a question? Because this is a political think tank, right? What made us do books?
That's a really good question. We're, at one level, we're a political think tank, but we're a policy think tank first and foremost, and it's policy informed by ideas, and it's policy informed by ideas of the importance of the individual, the importance of our culture, the rule of law, the protection and defence and extension of our freedoms. And one of the things that we've, as I mentioned when we launched the Foundations program a few years ago, have been very cognizant of is the fact that if we don't know our history, if we don't know where ideas of freedom came from, then they're not going to be defended. And our ideas of freedom have come from 3,000 or more years of Western civilization. They've come from our English common law tradition. And they've also come from literature and fiction and culture and the arts. And what Andrew and I and James have been talking about in the series are concepts such as how are we to live? What is it to be an individual? How do you know what is real and what is not? Or in these days, well, we talked about Don Quixote the other day, these days you'd call it fake news, and that's a 400-year-old discussion. So we're having a talk about books to give people a different perspective on freedom, on ideas, on our history, and also to have some fun and give people an insight into things that have made our culture.
I'd add on to that, if it was the 10 great policy papers of our civilization, it would be very tough to get Dad in the studio.
Well, no, they'd all be IPA policy papers.
Yeah, exactly. So just the 10 most recent. Sorry, we'll go through...
And we've only been going 75 years, not 400 years.
Yeah, well, you know, for now. So we'll go through the 10 books. So we've got Bleak House by Charles Dickens, The Leopard by Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa, Wuthering Heights, Zorba the Greek, Don Quixote, Heart of Darkness, The Way We Live Now, Radetzky March, Pride and Prejudice, and The Brothers Karamazov. So 10 really great books, 10 huge impactful books in society. So make sure you're downloading on iTunes or Podbean if you want to listen to them. So I want to say to you, John, which was the first one on the list of the 10 for you?
Well, when Andrew and I started tossing around this idea, we talked about doing different things. So it might be books of history, as you said, books of philosophy or politics. But interestingly, we came down on literature and fiction, because that's the greatest display of human creativity often, and it gives us, as I said, a different perspective on freedoms and what it is to be an individual. There were a couple that stood out straight away. Emily Bronte, I suggested, Andrew accepted with alacrity. Andrew has always been a big fan of The Leopard, which is a great book of... Mm-hmm.
So Emily Bronte's being Wuthering Heights.
Absolutely.
For people that haven't read it, yep.
The Leopard, as I mentioned, as a story of history and cultural change. We both agreed on Don Quixote straight away. And then we had a bit of a discussion about which were his favourites and which were my favourites. And we came down on a couple of books that not as many readers might know, but which deserve to be known well. So, for example, that's Zorba the Greek, The Radetzky March by Joseph Roth, which is a fantastic novel by a great middle century writer. And then you've got classics like Pride and Prejudice, which I've always enjoyed. So we winnowed down a big list, and we called it the great books, not the greatest books, because that's a subject of endless debate, and there's many other books that could have been on the list. But
and there might be a season two. We don't know yet, but there might be.
Or season 14.
Maybe. So we've recorded five now. So which one, what are the themes that are sort of striking you as we go through them? What are the big ideas that are coming out of the five that we've recorded so far?
Well, it's interesting to ponder that the ideas are common across all of the books. And one of the things that has struck IPA members and they've spoken to me about is the range of books by men and women, but also outside of the English language. And they're common themes around how are we to live, what is the purpose of our relationships, questions around do we try and be truthful, do we try and be honest, do we attempt to be sometimes something that we are not, either to achieve the love of one's life or to achieve success in employment or success in other fields. And then the other thing is, and this is something that has changed over the course of the last 400 years, if you study some of the books we've been talking about, is different attitudes even towards death. There's a certain mortality and fatality around some of the books, which you don't find in modern literature in the same way. You find a sense of pessimism also evened out with optimism. So I think you get more of a sense in some of the older books around the idea that life is part of ups and downs, and that life is sometimes okay and sometimes life will treat you well and sometimes it'll be quite difficult, which comes back to the point, and I was only half joking, that we feel like Jordan Peterson, which is the point that Jordan Peterson makes, which we've lost a sense of in the modern world, which is you deal with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, which is Shakespeare, which we're not doing yet, but which we might do.
So you say modern literature is more negative, more pessimistic.
No, no, I'm saying older literature tends to be more pessimistic and more fatalistic.
Okay.
And accepts the idea that perhaps things won't always go as you plan for them to be, mm-hmm. and you make the best of it, compared to some of the modern literature, I would argue, which deals with different themes around, well, you're always going to be happy. Well, no, you're not always going to be happy. And, of course, the great book Don Quixote deals with the question of, well, how do you invent a reality to make you happy? Or if you really want to be pessimistic, how do you invent a reality to help you get through the day?
I know another thing that struck you with all of these books was the lives of the authors, and you really enjoyed researching that. So what have you picked up from reading about these authors for these books?
So it's been fun pondering the lives of the authors, because all of the books that we've chosen, I'd read at various times in my life, and I'd read them as a reader, and I'd read them for entertainment. And luckily, I don't think I had to study any of these books at school, because if I had, I would have been turned off them for life, like Thomas Hardy, for example.
It's always the way with books.
It's always the way. Yeah. And now coming back and reading the books, looking to explain them and studying the lives of the authors, one thing really strikes you, which is all of the authors worked very hard. They worked very hard at writing. They practiced a lot. Invariably, they started the process of writing at a very young age and worked and worked and worked. And there's one or two like Joseph Conrad who came to novel writing late, but often people started in their teens. And again, this cuts across one of the modern themes, which is, well, brilliance is just how you feel like at the moment, and we can all be Steve Jobs or John Lennon. Well, you know, Steve Jobs and John Lennon had been practicing in what they do for a long time. And this idea that you will get better by doing something relentlessly and sometimes in a boring way and sometimes in a grinding way is really demonstrated by these books. Charles Dickens, who is imaginative and creative and funny, would churn that up to 3,000 or 4,000 words a day. And it's about hard work and striving and often just persisting.
Yeah, the old Edison quote, genius being 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very good get, James. What is the best book? So obviously, you know, there's going to be a lot of controversy about which books got in and which books didn't get in. What's the best book that didn't get in?
War and Peace.
Okay.
Sorry to say that.
What about, no, Shakespeare? Peter.
Well, Shakespeare are plays, and I personally have always found them difficult, and you can read a Shakespeare play with a dictionary of Old English and struggle through, or you can pick up War and Peace. And the trouble with War and Peace is that all the stereotypes about it are true. It is long, it is detailed, it is complex and complicated, but it is a magnificent story. And again, it comes to this idea of how you are to live, the different roles that you might have throughout your life. And then the other book that if ever we were to do a Series 2 or Series 14, I would lobby Andrew on would be Moby Dick, which I think is the great existential novel of our age. And then you might chuck in some Camus, some Orwell, and then some of the more political books.
Very cool. So the podcast is The Great Books of Literature. It's available on iTunes and Podbean. So go out, make sure you're listening to that. Make sure you're subscribed as well. And if you do like the podcast, make sure you are leaving it a 5-star review.
It's a great listen.
Yeah. So let's change tracks. So by the time people have heard this interview, so we're recording on Thursday afternoon. By the time people are listening to this, we probably have a new Prime Minister. We don't know who it is yet. And in your article in the Australian Financial Review, when all of this leadership stuff was going down, you point out that it almost doesn't matter who it is. The problem is the Liberal Party is just in a very, very deep hole right now, and they don't know who they are and what they stand for. Do you want to talk about what the Liberal Party needs to do?
I've explained it in the piece, and I've said it previously, that to some extent the Liberal Party is engaged in an existential crisis. It's a product of many things. It's a product of personalities, but politics is always about personalities and factions and advancements and preferments. So that's at one level. But Australian politics and the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have this apply. This applies to them as well. Is the product of 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth, which is a wonderful achievement and has contributed to the wonderful standard of living we experience in Australia at the moment. But it also breeds a sense of complacency. It breeds a sense of policy laziness. It breeds a sense that any social policy can be paid for and can be afforded. And Australians have avoided making difficult choices. And so, for example, from an IPA perspective, our dignity of work program is really important. I don't think many Australians recognise that the total number of unemployed Australians who have been unemployed for more than 12 months is at its highest levels ever. So while we have relatively low levels of unemployment, we have massive underemployment, we have long-term unemployment, we have youth employment in some centres of 20 to 30%, but economic success has disguised that, and I don't think the Liberal Party has dealt with that, which is one of the reasons why they won't engage in industrial relations reform. The willingness of the Liberal Party, I would argue, to follow the Labor Party down the path of a number of left-wing policies that have seen higher taxes, more regulation, I think counters not just what the Liberal Party stands for, but what Australia needs, which is an idea of greater personal responsibility and understanding that as individuals, we are the best judge as to how our money should be spent. And from that flows the idea that taxes should be lower, red tape should be reduced, and government should be smaller. But what I see is a Liberal Party that at times is afraid to differentiate itself from the Labor Party, whether it because it believes it can't mount an argument or whether it believes it's what the public want. But the reason we're having this discussion at the IPA is because we believe the ideas of freedom will always win out. And what disappoints me about the Liberal Party over the last few years is its singular lack of willingness to argue a case, whether it is a case for smaller government or freedom of speech or freedom of religion or our culture. They've been afraid to do that. And I think that's part of the reason why the Liberal Party is in the problem that it has.
So what are some specific policies that you'll really be hoping to see in the next few days or weeks?
Well, so these are some of the things I outlined in my piece in the Australian Financial Review. Some of them include a real discussion about freedom of speech and the abolition of Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, which is a major and significant restriction on freedom of speech. And flowing from that, things like a discussion about the abolition of the Human Rights Commission. Energy has been, and climate change has been a key issue of debate and arguably the touchstone to bring down Malcolm Turnbull, but I think it's been many reasons beyond that. Daniel Wilde this week released a wonderful paper on how Australia should withdraw from the Paris Agreement. At the very least, because the main four emitting countries are not abiding by their commitments. And so you have a debate about that. We must have a debate about the level of taxes and the size of government. The size of government in Australia at the federal level is at its highest level in 20 years. And while government is growing, we have things like business investment at its lowest level as a share of the economy since Gough Whitlam. Less small businesses are being started, as Matthew Lesh has demonstrated. We have to have a debate about enterprise and about growing the pie. And the thing that shocks me about the Liberal Party is they're following down the path of the Labor Party, which is about policies of redistribution and taking from one group and taking to the other and giving to the other rather than growing the economy. And then, as I raise in my article, we have an entire question about culture, about identity politics and the idea that we are different rather than the same, which I think is starting to permeate every aspect of the cultural discourse and our education and our civil society.
Absolutely.
I just think, just I don't want to, I know we're getting on in the interview, but I think you're being a bit kind. You know, we've got like...
I'm trying to be positive, Peter.
27
He's
years...
an optimistic man.
He is an optimistic man. Optimistic organisation, but 27 years of uninterrupted growth. But that there's a couple... That's not per capita.
Correct.
But that's underpinned by population growth.
That's right. And, you mentioned population growth. I don't think either of the major political parties are dealing with the legitimate and widespread community concern about whether our infrastructure, whether our civil society systems can deal with record levels of population growth. I think Australia should be a bigger, larger, stronger country, but it has to be supported by the community, and we have to have the infrastructure and the systems and the processes to deal with it. And you're dead right. The idea that we must maintain a massive immigration program to continue delivering on economic growth avoids the question, which is, in fact, per capita economic growth has declined.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, there's people struggling, you know, wage stagnation, people unemployed, it's difficult to buy a house for a lot of people, and that they're all difficult economic problems. We've got a story in the United States of someone who's making massive changes to tax, for example, that's working out really well. Why it shouldn't be that hard to sell that story to the Australian people.
Well, I would argue that it isn't. We have a slightly different system from the US. I think parliamentary democracy is sometimes harder than presidential politics. Yeah. I think it is harder to do a Trump in the UK or Australia than in the US. But that said, I don't think either party has engaged in a conversation with the Australian public about how do we maintain our high wage community with a high social safety net. And that is going to involve a discussion around industrial relations reforms, tax federalism and other things. And the things that the politicians are talking about, I think, are a long way away from the concerns of families and voters.
Okay, so John's article is available on our Facebook page, and don't forget to download and subscribe to the Great Books of Literature podcast. We've got a new episode coming out on Tuesday with The Leopard. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, we now welcome back to the show Daniel Wild, research fellow here at the IPA. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, Daniel Wild thing.
G'day, mate.
Now, last week was a big week for Dan. We would have loved to have had you on the show last week, but you did get bumped for Douglas Murray, so sorry about that.
Oh, it's understandable.
Yeah, but so last week you came out with a report, Why Australia Must Exit the Paris Climate Agreement. Now, this went pretty big, got a lot of play in the media, and all I'm saying, and I'm not saying causation, but I am saying that, you know, around the time that Turnbull backed down from the Paris Climate Agreement legislation was when he started to get rolled. Again, not caused, but interesting.
Make of that what you will.
These are two facts that are true.
Yes.
They are true. And they could be linked.
Well, we're not saying that. But this is a big report, and I don't want to embarrass you, but you were on the Alan Jones radio show, and I've just got a little bit of audio here of just how much Alan Jones was appreciating it.
The government needs to abandon the Paris Climate Agreement, get out of the emissions reductions game, and needs to stop subsidising wind and solar, because they're inferior, they're intermittent, they're weather-dependent, and they cannot provide reliable, low-cost, baseload power like you get from coal.
God, this is Daniel Wild from the IPA. Aren't these young people, these are all young blokes, aren't they the hope of the side? There are people out there who are rational, clear thinkers and do their homework, and that's what you just said is right.
So Alan Jones, clearly a big fan of the report. That must be pretty happy for you.
Yeah, it was great to get some media traction, and you know, a lot of people are pretty exercised about electricity policy in the country. We know prices are up 130% in about the last decade, and that's because of the subsidisation of wind and solar at the expense of coal, and the Paris Climate Agreement would have embedded that. Now, what the agreement requires is that Australia reduces its emissions by at least 26% on 2005 levels by 2030, and that means you're going to have more wind and more solar coming onto the grid, and there's actually no room for more coal-fired power stations. Even though we've got 1,000 years worth of coal, we've got 30% of the world's uranium supplies, we sit on a bed of gas, none of those resources are being utilised in the way they should, and so that's driving up electricity prices. In that report, we calculated that the cost of Paris would be $52 billion, and that's about $8,500 per family in Australia.
Cool. So how is that $52 billion calculated? Is that like lost economic output or like direct
cost? It's actually a very conservative estimate, which just estimates the additional cost of generating electricity owing to the fact that wind and solar are less reliable and more expensive than coal. So if you're going to get rid of emissions reductions policies, you've got to have more reliable baseload power coming from coal and less intermittent weather-dependent energy coming from wind and solar. Now, what you've also got is the flow-on economic consequences. So, obviously, higher electricity prices means higher cost of operating a business. So, you're going to have less business investment, less job creation, lower wages growth. And the higher cost of electricity obviously flows through to goods and services. So, they're going to be more expensive as well.
Yeah. And then also families will be spending more on their own electricity bills and not putting money back into, you know, other shopping areas, which could help that in turn as well.
Yeah, exactly. Paying school fees, you know, health insurance.
Farmers.
Farmers. So
have to pay electricity costs.
Farmers have to pay electricity costs. Everyone has to. So, it flows right through the economy. It's the lifeblood of the economy.
Yeah.
And everybody's negatively affected by it. And the important thing is it doesn't really make a difference what we do in Australia from an environmental perspective. So, yeah, it's all pain and no gain.
And this is one of those things, you know, like because we could have such cheap electricity, it is just frustrating, and it's such a major cost across all the economy. I would say you don't often hear Jonesy have like a sort of sharp intake of breath after such an answer, so that's a really big achievement from you. Well done. One of my favourite things about this report was, and there's lots of great info in there, was actually the front cover. So that was a hellish inferno.
You brought this up at the show last week. You've really been taken with the cover.
Well, I want to get Daniel's take on it. It's a hellish inferno that you and our designer here, Sammy Cerrone, have worked on together. Tell us about that more.
Well, that's all Sammy. That's all. Sammy is an absolute champion. He's our graphic designer and web man and does everything that needs to be done on the end of getting reports out. And he's an absolute genius. And he comes up with all of those graphics. Yeah. He made it look very hellish.
Yeah.
He obviously understood that we're basically burning money. That's what the cover is, basically a hellish kind of inferno of money going up and no offsetting benefit. So yeah, it's a great cover and well done to Sammy.
He just said, I'll give this report a bit of punch, mate.
Bit of punch. Mm. Yeah, it captures the essence of it, so good on him.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Very cool. So right now, Malcolm Turnbull is prime minister. So Malcolm Turnbull says we're not going to pursue the Paris Agreement policies that he came up with. Energy policy now a bit up in the air. And whether or not he's going to be prime minister is also up in the air. We're recording this on a Thursday. Cormann, Fifield, and who's the third? Michaela Cash. Just announced that they were no longer supporting Turnbull. So, you know, there's probably a million things that are going to happen between us recording this interview and listeners hearing it. So just to date where we're at. So we're probably going to have a new prime minister soon enough. What should energy policy be for that new prime minister?
Well, they've got to get out of Paris Climate Agreement and focus on getting prices down and improving reliability rather than reducing emissions. The problem we've had over the last decade is emissions reductions have been at the center of energy policy, whether it's renewable energy target, carbon tax. The now dead National Energy Guarantee would have done the same thing, which was the Turnbull government's main policy vehicle for implementing the Paris Climate Agreement. So the key thing here is just to focus on getting electricity prices down. That means getting out of Paris, ending all subsidies to solar and wind energy generation, and abolishing the variety of government agencies like the Clean Energy Foundation and there's a couple of others at the Commonwealth level that provide just billions of dollars in taxpayer handouts to solar and wind energy generation. So it's time to stop emissions reductions. There's this idea that the transition to renewables is inevitable. We have to have a low carbon future, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all just political inventions. There's nothing inevitable about it. We know that coal-fired power stations are being built in the hundreds around the world. It's time
especially
to use...
Especially China. Yeah.
Especially China, Vietnam, Indonesia, Japan, you know, everywhere. And they use our coal, right? We export 80% of our coal to these countries. So it's time for us to start using it.
If you've killed the NEG, why can't you just kill the Paris Climate Agreement?
Yeah, aim higher, Dan.
Well, sorry.
Go international.
Well, that'll be next week.
Go globalist.
They're both, get the globalists. They're both related. So the NEG, the National Energy Guarantee, was the policy vehicle for implementing the Paris Climate Agreement. Mm. So to the extent that we played a very small role in that, I think that that's
not the line, Dan.
Well, you know, it's good to hopefully have got that on the agenda and gotten a bit of media coverage that raises the profile of it as a very bad policy.
Cool. All right.
Just one more on that. So we've talked a little bit about Australia having no impact on it. Australia is actually meeting their obligations on this agreement, but in the EU, not a single country has, of course.
Well, the really interesting thing is the top four emitters in the world are either not in Paris, they're not constrained by Paris, or they're not on target to meet their requirements. So as you say, not one EU nation is on target. Now, they count the EU as one block, and that's the third largest emitter, so not one of them are on target. We know that the US is going to withdraw. It's the second largest emitter. China's the largest emitter and its emissions go up under Paris. And India is the fourth largest emitter. And the interesting thing about India is that it would be meeting its Paris obligations under the business as usual scenario, which means that it doesn't have to change its policy settings. So the top four emitters aren't constrained by it. Why is Australia?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Very good.
So let's change track. So the other thing that came out, so this was an absolute political masterstroke from Turnbull. So he calls a press conference, everyone's thinking it's going to be about leadership, and instead he just announces that corporate tax cuts are gone, which was like one of his major policies. Like got every journalist in the country to tune in to watch him announce a failure. But the wider point of that is corporate tax cuts are now dead for a little bit. So this is something that you've been working on a lot. Explaining why corporate tax cuts are going to help the Australian economy. So it's a big shame that they are gone. So what has Australia just cost itself with Turnbull saying no more corporate tax cuts?
Well, we know that the benefit of the total corporate tax cut package, which was originally to reduce Australia's tax rate from 30% to 25% for all businesses by 2027, 2028, or 2026, 2027, for the total policy to go through, that was going to be worth about $17 billion, with about two-thirds of that benefit going through to households in terms of higher real wages. Now, they have got a portion of those tax cuts through for smaller businesses, but as you say, they haven't got it through for larger businesses. I think it was inevitable that they had to drop it just because the public support had eroded, and that was driven by the issue with the banks, with the Royal Commission into the financial sector. So a lot of people equated, you know, tax cuts for banks being bad, even though banks are only a small proportion of the total large businesses that would have benefited. So it's really not a good thing. Australia has one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. We know that business investment is at near crisis level lows. So we need more businesses to come here, and we need to be reducing the corporate tax rate. I think it needs to be 10 or 15% in order to be competitive again.
Yeah, you bring up how no one wanted to give tax cuts to the banks. And I thought like another part of that was people that didn't want the corporate tax cuts, like organizations that didn't want the tax cuts, did a really cool campaign about, you know, it's not the fair share, which I think really resonated. Mm. Where was the Business Council of Australia or other big businesses saying, you know, actually we do pay our fair share, and also if the lower tax cuts come in, we can employ more people?
Yeah. So to be fair to some of those organizations, they, like the Business Council, was out there a fair bit making the argument. Maybe they didn't get as much media traction as they could have, but they were making the argument. I'm not, a lot of the business groups have sort of been missing in action on a lot of these important policies, whether it's tax cuts, cutting red tape, or having a sensible energy policy. A lot of them have been missing in action. I'm not too sure what's going on there, but you're right. The opposition was much stronger, much more targeted. I think they delivered a good message, even though I think it's completely incorrect, which was, rather than giving X billion dollars in quote-unquote handouts to banks, why don't we fund hospitals? Now, tax cuts aren't handouts. You know, that's ridiculous. It's taking less of someone else's money is not giving them money back, right? Because that assumes that the government owns your income, which they don't. So it's completely false, but it was effective. So
why is it so difficult for Australian politics? So we've just seen in America a massive company tax cut and economic benefits come through. Why is it so difficult for us? And this is a political question, so maybe it's, you know, unfair to put it on you. But why is it so difficult for Australian politicians to explain this to people?
Oh, that's a really good.
If we had a massive cut in tax,
yeah,
everyone would be better off.
It's a really good question. There's a few things.
It.
I think
that's the message. I could do it.
Get Peter Gamera.
In there. It should be press officer.
Yeah.
I think a part of it is Australians are a bit more skeptical of business. In America, there's Americans don't begrudge successful billionaires. They don't, Mitt Romney, you know, Donald Trump, they don't begrudge them. They sort of celebrate it because they believe that they can be that person.
Yeah, what's that, like the temporarily embarrassed billionaires? Like every American sees himself as that?
Yeah.
It's an old saying. I don't know.
What's that?
It's like a saying, like the reason Americans always worship big, like, well, not worship, but respect big businessmen is because they see themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Like, I'm working this job now, but the next
day, I'll be there. Okay. Yeah, I'll be a waitress now, but I'll be a movie star exactly, in 10 years. Yeah. Well, that's the attitude. So they don't begrudge you. They're like, yeah, we want you to make money. Good on you. There's a bit of a different attitude in Australia, which is probably more skeptical of businesses and big businesses. Why that is, I don't know. It's a cultural thing. And also just the political leadership isn't really there. And Donald Trump was ambitious and communicated it well. Whereas here, the policy was just a 5 percentage point cut over 10 years. I mean, that just lacks any kind of ambition. And so if you're someone in voter land and you've got the government saying, well, cutting taxes is really important, but we're only going to cut it by a little bit over a really long period of time, that just loses any kind of, the message just gets lost. It's like, well, if it's so good, why don't you do more immediately? Mm. And that's what they should have done.
Very cool.
Like being hit with a warm lettuce leaf.
We're really struggling to execute our sayings the last 5 minutes.
A wet one, that's
it. Yeah. A wet one, mate.
All right, cool. So, Daniel, the report is why Australia must exit the Paris Climate Agreement. You can go see that on the IPA website, ipa.org.au. And if you do want to listen to that Alan Jones interview, that's available on our SoundCloud page. Just look up the Institute of Public Affairs. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Cool.
Thanks, Pete.
Okay, thank you to John and Daniel for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So make sure you guys are checking out the reports and the articles on our website.
Yep.
And yeah, and make sure you download the Great Books of Literature podcast.
It is honestly excellent. I didn't want to say it here when John was in the room in case he got
well,
a
you did
head.
Say it.
Oh, did I?
You did say that it's an excellent listen.
Yeah, well, it is really good.
Cool. So let's run through some stories that made us laugh this week. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the darling of the far left, and she's quite quickly become the darling of the right as well, just through the absolute content that she delivers us. If you guys don't know, so she's this woman in her 20s, and she ran against a very high-profile Democrat, and so she's now a candidate for United States Congress coming up. So, darling of the left, now becoming quick of the right, and two articles this week should show you why. So, she has been copying it in a bit in interviews, and she's kind of getting exposed a little. So, this week, this coming out from Reason, Democratic Socialist House candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez banned reporters from attending several of her public town hall events this week. The candidate's campaign manager tells us that the ban was implemented after reporters mobbed her last week following a community meeting. There will be no more Q&A and no more one-on-one interviews.
She also said that one of the reasons they didn't let reporters in was because they might make people at the event feel uncomfortable.
Oh.
So almost like they're enemies of the people.
Hmm.
Anyway,
this is one of the ones where you can file under if Trump did it. If Trump banned press from a town hall, front page news for weeks.
That's the whole. I mean, you know, she's not the president, but like, why? Where's the newspapers talking about her?
Yeah,
so cutting back on free speech.
And I guess the other side of it is, if you are going to be a socialist person running for Congress, there's nothing more on brand you can do than banning the press from reporting you negatively.
Yeah, at least she's not sort of, you know, being dishonest.
Yeah, exactly. I'm playing my cards open, guys. The cold, hard, dark heart of a tyrant beats within.
Yeah, so...
And then you got this other story of her. So, well, this one is more of a thing around her, but it's still fun. So, one of the things about her... Well, you know, I feel bad for the people who work there, but... One of the things that she was running on was she used to work in a coffee shop, and that's how, you know, she's like, she was working from the working class and she was serving the coffee to the rich people in Manhattan, and sort of builds this idea of who she is and when she ran for parliament.
Yeah.
She worked at the coffee shop in Union Square, Manhattan. Now, this place is about to close, and the owner, Charles Millite, I don't know the guy. Charles Millite told the New York Post last month.
In New York.
I want to. Charles Millite told the New York Post last month, the rents are very high and now the minimum wage is going up and we have a huge number of employees. The coffee store is about to close.
Yeah.
So the minimum wage is about to kill the coffee place.
Well, you know.
Again.
No, I can't say that. No, like, no, you don't say.
You don't say.
Anyway, struggling with my words today, but my understanding is, and I'm no expert, my understanding is the iconic coffee shop in Union Square that they're talking about is actually quite famous.
Yeah, apparently it's a big boy.
And like you said, you know, it's a very sort of wealthy part of Manhattan, and the people that work there aren't wealthy. So it is a kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, but it's like, again, it's like minimum wage, the thing that Cortez wants to more than double.
Yes, yeah,
is the thing that's destroying businesses and making sure that poor people can't get jobs.
Exactly right. That's why we talk about the dignity of work, James.
Absolutely.
Regulation, red tape, all that stuff.
All right, cool.
Because it's the poorest people in society that miss out.
It is indeed. Shall we move on to another story, Pete?
Let's move on, because I've got a story for you. In Liverpool, United Kingdom, it's illegal to say, and I want to get the quote exactly right, it's illegal to say women don't have penises. Not illegal. You'll get investigated by the police if you say that. There's a group in Liverpool called... Sorry, I've just got my notes are a bit messy here. They're a TERF group, and that means they're a trans-exclusionary radical feminist group. They're called the Liverpool Resistors. And what that means... So these aren't evil white men who are the worst people in the world. These are feminists who think that trans women shouldn't be regarded as real women or something like that. I don't really understand. But they stuck penis-shaped stickers all over monuments and stuff like that in Liverpool. Nina's looking at me with a funny look on her face. It says, women don't have penises. They got reported to the police, and the Merseyside police are investigating them for that.
It's a pretty tough one.
It is.
Yeah. I don't have a whole lot to say on this one. Like, I mean...
It's funny.
Yeah. Like, are they actually being prosecuted for saying it, or are they being investigated for, like, public graffiti?
I don't know. No, I think it was along the lines of...
You can't say that.
Hate
crime.
Hate crime.
Right,
rather
okay.
than, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a good point. But this comes at the same time where West Yorkshire police are investigating people because they mocked them on their Facebook group.
Right.
And, of course, they're investigating Boris for a while about his comments, which are quite famous.
Yes.
So,
Once again.
It's just in the files, the free speech files.
The free speech files, and also as if Britain doesn't have enough to think about at the moment.
Yeah, as if Liverpool doesn't have enough problems, you know?
Yeah.
Like people putting penis stickers up.
Cool.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
That run really tickled me.
It really did. You've been running, like, you've been very happy with it.
Bo was sort of like, yeah, we can do it if you want. I was like, I really want.
It's your first item in the meeting.
Yeah. I came in, you know.
Just kicked down the door of my office.
We need to make a stand. Anyway.
I wasn't there, but Pete just still needed to kick it.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to Jamie Oliver.
Okay, yep, two in a row. So Jamie Oliver has been accused of cultural appropriation. I mean, this is always where it's going to end, isn't it?
Yeah, like Jamie Oliver.
Cooking something not from his country.
Yeah.
He made a punchy jerk rice, which is a Jamaican dish, and his take on a Jamaican dish. He got a lot of criticism for it because apparently it didn't taste very good, which is fair enough. But he also got criticism from Dawn Butler MP, who said, this is cultural appropriation. You don't understand how this food is made because you're not Jamaican. And there was a bit of an uproar about that, as there always is about cultural appropriation, which is stupid.
Yeah, she tweeted, your jerk rice is not okay. This appropriation from Jamaica needs to stop. Tough sell for any cook from like Britain or Holland
or Australia.
Just like the second you can't make dishes from other countries, you're really, it's not looking good for your future restaurant.
How do you like your boiled cabbage, James?
Yeah. We got lamingtons and we got pie.
You got meat pie.
Yeah, we got meat pie.
Roast lamb.
The other one I had
damper?
Here.
Kangaroo? Sorry, I'll stop.
Keep going. I can do this for another 20
like
minutes.
Like turtle, like indigenous food can be quite nice, I think.
Yes. White cooks won't be able to make
that's
that.
That's true.
Sorry.
That's a good point.
I was going to say, so he's in trouble for making jerk rice, which is a really...
Punchy jerk rice.
Punchy jerk rice. Well, I was going to say, isn't any rice dish that Jamie Oliver makes jerk rice?
This is the crap joke you were talking about.
I told Pete, I've got the worst joke, and yeah. I'm going to actually cause you physical pain.
Yeah, no, but I enjoyed that.
Thank you. Cool. So that's...
I've got one more point on this.
Okay, cool.
He, to his credit, didn't apologise.
Good.
He just said... You know, I use ingredients from my
world. I give it one day before there's an apology.
And he does do that whole school foods thing, which is a little bit
odd. Yeah, big fan of the sugar tax as well.
Yeah, so, but I mean, that just might mean he doesn't get economics. But
yeah.
Anyway, didn't apologise, so good on him.
Cool, so one thing we want to mention at the end of the show, the Spectator Australia is hosting an Anglo-Australian Forum in Sydney next month. Spectator Australia have been really good. They've ran a lot of IPA articles in the past, and we've also had Rowan Dean on the show. Mm-hmm. So if you guys want to go to the Spectator Australia website. So it's the Anglo-Australian Forum. They've got a bunch of really cool speakers. Tony Abbott, Nigel Farage, Janet Albrechtson, IPA board member, and politicians such as Steve Chiobo and Matt Canavan, among others. So make sure you're going over to the Spectator website and getting your ticket. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you to John Roskam and Daniel Wild. Make sure you are checking out the Great Books of Literature podcast. Next episode out on Tuesday. Make sure you're also reading Daniel's report on why that Australia should get out of Paris. And thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Podbean. You guys can download it now, so make sure you're going back and listening to the Douglas Murray interview, and make sure you're leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Nina, how can people become a member of the IPA?
Well, just visit the website, ipa.org.au, call us, and joining as low as $22 per year, you'll become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. See you guys next week.
Bye, everyone.